Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here in Wisconsin Dells at that conference. I'm pretty excited to be here in the Open Spaces room with the venerable Uncle Bob. How you doing, bud?
Venerable. Yeah. I'm venerable, thank you.
Nice. Well, once, like, here's the thing, right? You don't meet many of, like, the seasoned, grizzled programmers anymore.
Grizzled.
It's like the get off my lawn types. Where are they?
We're all still here. We've been around forever. Most of us are still writing code. It's just there never were very many of us.
My goodness. So you did a really interesting keynote. And I'm going to start with a story. And I told you this earlier. I used to work for a politician. He's actually in Congress right now. And every once in a while, they call me. And they're like, hey, we have this idea for legislation.
Yeah.
And there was something in your talk that just sort of sparked this memory of mine. I'll finish my story once you tell us. Tell us about that part of the talk.
Well, that part of the talk is the kind of the climax of the talk.
Sorry.
And I, you know, I set the stage by saying, you know, that software is everywhere and everyone in our society interacts with it on a minute-by-minute basis, whether you're driving a car or pushing buttons on a microwave oven or turning on your dishwasher,
Yeah. You're
interacting with software. And unfortunately, it's gotten to the point where our software is in a position where it can hurt people, it can damage people. So the software in your car, for example, can make the car go out of control and kill people. And this has happened. There have been people killed by software. Lots of money has been lost because of software. There have been catastrophes. And one day there will be a catastrophe that is so large that the world will not be able to ignore it. And the politicians of the world will rise up in righteous indignation and they will demand that something be done. And what can the politicians do but legislate and regulate and tell us what languages we can use and what frameworks we can use and what process steps we have to go through. And I'd really like to avoid that.
Yeah, I mean, and this really, I mean, it's like, duh, I kind of knew this, but the most brilliant things are the things that you are like, oh, yeah. There could be a time where some huge disaster happens, and people are like, it's the software's fault.
Yes, right.
Who wrote this?
Who wrote this code?
Should we put them in jail?
What's wrong with these software people? And by the way, then you'll have a lot of people chiming up saying, there's a lot wrong with them.
Yeah, I mean, like, and this has already happened. There's been billions lost over software glitches and trading.
Sure. Program. Knight Capital, that whole nonsense, and the, what was it, the bank that where everybody's balance went to zero in England a few years ago. Yeah, and terrible, terrible stuff.
But nobody died, thankfully.
But people have died in cars.
Yeah.
And then there was a power outage in the Northeast that was software related, and that killed people. So software is becoming a matter of life and death.
So, but here's the thing. Software originally, like when they were doing NASA missions to the moon, was literally a matter of life and
death.
Yes,
it was. Yes, it was.
But somehow it still worked.
Yes.
So what's the difference between then and sort of now? Because you went into this a lot.
Yes. Well, the kind of the difference between then and now has to do with the people who were writing it then and the people who are writing it now. Back in those days, the programmers did not begin their careers as programmers.
Of course, there was no such thing.
There weren't computers, right?
Yeah.
Computers were invented while these people were actually working at other jobs. And they moved into the profession of programming from careers in science or engineering or mathematics. Uh-huh. And they had already learned the disciplines and the professionalism, and they carried that with them. In the 70s, that all changed. When all of a sudden programmers were 20-year-olds, 22-year-olds, and startups began, and people had to go boom, 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 and write code really, really fast. And the whole attitude changed. So that now we have the startup culture. Now we have this incredible pressure to go fast without going well.
I see.
And the thing that the old guys knew, the guys who did the Apollo missions and the guys who did the aircrafts and the submarines and things like that, what they knew was that you can't go fast unless you go well. So you go well first, and that makes you go fast. If you go fast first, then all you do is make a mess.
Yeah, and I and there's the picture that I always remember. I don't know what this lady's name is, but she's standing there next to like a stack of code that she wrote for one of these space missions, and I'm thinking there must have been like a lot of really smart people. I'm not saying there's not smart people now, but they're using their smarts for speed and not necessarily for well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any difference in intelligence. I think, you know, the programmers we have today are smart people. But the culture is not a culture of carefulness.
I see.
It's a culture of, we got to get it out and who cares what it looks like.
I see, like the minimum viable product.
So where did this whole idea come from that you can ship your beta? Who thought of that? Right? Who said, oh, well, you know what? We'll just ship the beta. And you know what? We'll just tell everybody it's a beta, so screw you. What? Where did that come from? Where did the whole idea come from that software's crap, just live with it?
And here's my first, every software engineer has to have their failure. I had mine, we were working for a plumbing company, and we tried to do like waterfall type stuff, and we got all the requirements, we started building it, and they said, this is not what we want.
When you were done?
And we were mostly on the way to being done, and I'm like, well, this is what you said.
That's what you said.
But that's not what we want. And so, like, that was my first colossal failure as a software developer, and it stayed with me. And I think it led that kind of sort of methodology, because it felt like I was told in college, you have to use the waterfall method, because that's what you got to use. But then something happened, and you were part of this, and I think it was 2001
in Park City, Utah.
Yeah. Talk about that and what led to that.
Yeah, so... So here you got, it's 2001, and there's a bunch of us who have decided to meet at Snowbird.
Lovely place, by the way.
Yeah, it is a real nice place.
I'm just saying, it's really nice.
And we discussed this whole idea of these lightweight processes that had begun to show up. So a few years before, you had Scrum show up. Mike Beadle and Ken Schwaber and Martin DeVoe had written a paper on that. And you had Kent Beck, who was talking about extreme programming. And you had Alistair Coburn talking about the crystal process. A lot of these processes, little processes. And they were all kind of a rebellion against this waterfall mentality that we had developed 30 years before, probably because we were all so damn young, we didn't know what the hell we were doing.
Yeah.
And somebody had to impose some
kind
of...
Well, the field was young, too.
Of course it was, yeah. So here we are at Snowbird, and we try to look at all of these... lightweight processes and divine what they all have in common. And we come up with the famous four statements, right? You know, interactions over
process
and collaboration over contract and working code over specifications and all of this quatrain that we developed. And somehow that became extremely popular. I don't know how, but just
well,
everybody
started. It was at Snowbird, I mean, obviously.
Yeah, it was probably
a good resort,
But that was an example of these guys who had started very young, lived through the waterfall era for 30 years, and then looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is wrong. And what we came up with in that room at Snowbird was pretty much what the guys who did the Apollo missions and the jet planes before that had been doing for a very long time. Those old programmers who had by this time left the field had been doing what we would now call Agile.
Oh,
somebody said once that Agile is the way programmers are seen to behave in the wild.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but they had the maturity and the discipline to do it because they had come from other fields. They already were professionals. And so they could apply what was obvious.
That's interesting, and I've seen this, and I'm maybe 20 years a programmer, not that long. I started when I was like 16. I have seen this like expansion of things, you know, and then it's like no, we need to go back, I've seen at least maybe one or two of those iterations now, where that's happening. Like for example, in the API space, where you went full WSDL, which was like, and now we're going back to these sort of micro sort of API. Are you seeing this type of thing when it comes to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we live in the web world right now, but what is the web world, right? Well, the web world is really the 3270 world from 30 years before that, just big, you know, client-server trade-off. Send me a packet, I'll take a packet. And we're having this battle, this constant battle. Where should the intelligence be? Should the intelligence be on the server? Should it be on the client? This is a 50-year-old battle. And it's just going back and forth and back and forth. And the pendulum swings back and forth all the time. That's right? Nobody ever gets it right because there is nothing right. There is no right answer.
There's just what's right for the customer at that time.
Yeah, just whatever. But people get into this fad mentality. They think, oh, it's right if we do it over here. And then 5 years later, oh, no, it's right if we do it over here.
I see.
We see the same kind of oscillation with statically typed languages and dynamically typed languages. Statically typed languages, dynamically typed languages.
And back and forth. And like this is an old, like static and dynamic language have been around forever.
Old, old idea, yeah. Fortran was a statically typed language. Right? Lisp was a dynamically typed language. Both of them 1950s, right? This stuff just goes back and forth, and there is no right answer.
So after the Agile Manifesto, there was sort of the craftsmanship movement that you kind of started.
Yeah.
What was it because the Agile Manifesto wasn't enough, or did it start out a certain way and end up a different way that needed to be something needed to happen?
So what happened here was that Ken Schwaber came to me in 2003, I think it was. And he said, Bob, I want to conduct a course in one of your classrooms. It's called a Certified Scrum Master course. And the people who are going to be in it are going to be certified Scrum Masters when they're done, and I'll give them a certificate, and it'll be great. And I thought he was nuts. Who's going to do this? But he wanted to do it in one of my classrooms, and I said, yeah, go ahead. And he borrowed my classroom and taught this course. It turned out to be a wild success. Everybody wanted to be a certified Scrum Master.
Yeah, I know.
CSM.
I've wanted to be one of
those. Well, I mean, who doesn't
want to? They told me I had to be. Someone said.
This took the whole Agile industry in this funny direction because the business world thought, oh, a certification, that's really cool. And a lot of project managers who had grown up in an environment where certificates meant something. You know, they had the whole PM BOC and all that stuff. All right, well, this is something new. So the project managers kind of grabbed the Agile movement and twisted it off to one side.
They re-waterfalled it, in essence.
Well, I don't know if waterfall's the right word, but they certainly took it and separated it from the technical side.
I see.
When we had sat at Snowbird, our concept at the time, or at least mine was, I can't speak for everybody, was that the technical and the business practices were interwoven. They're inseparable.
They should be, at least.
Kent Beck had said at that meeting that the goal here was to heal the divide between the business and the technical.
Right.
And when that CSM thing came out and was very popular, it had the effect of tearing those two apart. Because the Scrum side of things is fairly non-technical. Right? It's a lot of business practices.
Yeah.
But you don't carry the technical practices with them. And the technical practices got set aside. We had a whole bunch of companies doing Scrum, but not doing test-driven development, not doing pair programming, not doing refactoring, not doing
continuous integration. It's like the business integration model evolved, but the technology model did not.
Did not.
Okay.
So several years later, Martin Fowler called this flaccid Scrum. People have called it Scrum Butt. The idea is that you take a very powerful business process and you couple it to undisciplined technical teams, and you've got a great way to make a mess really fast.
Yeah, we've seen
and
it.
Slow down.
Yeah.
And we have seen it. Yes, we have seen it. So the craftsmanship movement evolved out of that frustration, which was another statement saying, wait, these technical practices are important. And the original goal of the craftsmanship movement was to grab the Agile movement and bring them around, and that didn't happen. So now we've got these two movements that are separating. And Kent Beck's original goal, which was the healing of the divide, has actually been thwarted. We are now seeing the divide. And we have to somehow turn that around.
How does one do that?
Well, my strategy is to yell really loud at as many conferences as I can. Some smarter person than me is going to have to figure out how to actually herd the cats, but I will yell about it because I think it's important.
And now to finish my story, to bring it all the way around, the lawyers from Washington called me And there had been some problems with a big software project that maybe some of you have heard of that came out. It was a legislated project. And
Did it have anything to do with healthcare?
Whether you agree with it or not is neither here nor there. Yeah. I'm looking at it merely on the technical aspects. When it came out, it was just bad.
Yeah.
So the lawyers, they called me and they said, Seth, we're thinking of making a law that to require all open source packages that the government uses to be bug free. And I'm so glad they called. Because I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. That's like requiring all houses to have ADT, but ignoring the hole in the back fence.
It must be bug free.
And that goes to what you were saying. The only thing, once this catastrophe happens, the only thing that the lawmakers can do is regulate software.
Yeah, and probably unintelligently. But they'll have to do it because the public will demand it.
And it won't be by their fault. As software engineers, maybe some of us haven't adhered to some kind of strict.
So we have to get there first.
Yeah.
We as a software community have to get there first and start defining the practices and the disciplines and the ethics. We have to form a profession. We have to be professionals. And in order to do that, you have to form a profession, establish disciplines, establish ethics, possibly even some kind of certification or licensing, like the AMA or the Bar Association or something like that. So that when the event occurs, when the disaster happens, because the disaster is going to happen,
we
can be there and say, look, you don't need to regulate us. We're already regulating ourselves. Here's our ethics. Here's our rules, our disciplines. If you want to give them the force of law, that's fine. We've already established them.
I remember, as a young engineer, I worked for the architects, contractors, and engineers.
Yeah.
And I went in once, and I gave the card. I was a senior software engineer, and he's like, what do you mean you're a senior? Are you certified? I have a certification from the state that says I can practice engineering, building stuff.
Yes.
You shouldn't call yourself an engineer. And at the time, I was young. I can call myself.
Yeah, I'm an engineer.
But now, as I'm starting to think about this, I had this conversation the other day. They're like, well, are you an engineer? And I thought, how do we get to, because software is so squishy, how do we get to the stringent certification requirements that you're talking about?
That's a very good question. So again, I'm just going to yell about it and make that somebody else's problem. The definition of an engineer is an interesting one. An engineer is a person who takes on the liability of what they create.
Just that alone changes the way I think about making stuff.
Right.
Because now I'm liable for this.
Yes, right. You're responsible.
And that means you have to be insured. It means maybe you're bonded. Just that one thought is crazy.
Well, it's certainly the direction we're going to have to go with engineering teams and software engineering groups. It may not be that everybody is bonded, but they have to be led by someone who is, or something. I don't know. Something is going to have to happen. What we're seeing in the industry right now is something very interesting, which is groups of software developers are coming together at certain companies. And those companies are identifying themselves with craftsmanship ideals and ethics. And those companies are gathering more and more to them. So it's kind of like a guild structure is beginning to show up. Maybe we'll see that continue.
Interesting. So what advice do you have for programmer? And the majority of programmers nowadays are maybe like 5 years into it.
Sure. That's always going to be true, right?
What advice do you have for them to maybe pick up the craft a little bit?
So I think the most important thing for a software developer, sit down and have a serious conversation with yourself about what your ethical stance is. What are your ethics? What do you believe in as far as the quality of what you create? And decide for yourself what line you will not cross, even if it means you get fired. And then stick to that line, hold that line. That will become your principle. find other people who have like-minded principles and start establishing groups and guilds and so on.
Interesting. So, to finish up, where can folks go to find out more about, because I know you put out some videos and you do some other stuff, where can folks go to find out?
So, I do an awful lot of videos on cleancoders.com. Mm-hmm. If you go there, you'll see me dress up like Spock. So,
We almost had him do that, but he didn't.
No. But yeah, there's lots of videos up there, about 40 hours worth of videos now. And in those videos, I talk about lots of technical stuff and discipline stuff and professionalism stuff. I kind of cover the gamut. And that's where you can go to hear more about this.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Thanks for coming down. Thanks for watching. We have a lot to think about, and we will see you next time. Take care.